Right, well, this talks about some new developments I've been working on, which I think may address what I believe are limitations in pheasant science. There's been a progression you all know about. There's classical mechanics and then quantum mechanics, and things are sort of stuck there, but quantum mechanics is really running into problems. More seriously, the thing which has interested me for many years is the fact that there seem to be lots of phenomena where mind is involved, where ordinary physics doesn't seem to give the right result. And this, in fact, leads to a very strange situation, a kind of pathology in science, which is the thing I'm also interested in. If you look up pathological disbelief in the web search, you'll find my lecture on the subject. The point is, people partly believe that present science is okay because they dismiss anything that doesn't fit in with it as nonsense. For example, people actually say telepathy is nonsense, despite the amount of work which has done. Well, it's partly people's experiences of their own telepathy, but there have been very careful experiments which have shown that things like telepathy and remote viewing are real things. Actually, there's a TV program I was in many years ago, and I put an extract to Google Video remote viewing, where the researcher was apparently able to see what was at a distance, describe it in detail. It was just as if she was there. So all sorts of strange things which are just dismissed because they don't fit with current dogma. And most of these things involve mind in some way, although there may be things like memory of water which are more complicated. But anyway, the point is that there is a question of how one can treat mind properly in physics, not regard it as something associated just with brains. And I think actually quantum mechanics may be going in a completely wrong direction now, because people are trying to build the wrong kind of picture of what's going on. We'll come to that in a moment. Now, in fact, I'll show in a moment, current physics is really starting off with the assumption that what's fundamental is matter. To be precise, it has equations which describe matter, and any new theory will normally have to have that form. And mind is secondary. Life and mind just come out of rare things, accidents, and there's no meaning to the universe, which many people think is not the case. But there's something which people are quite interested in these days, however, but it's rather unorthodox science, which is to argue that somehow mind is at the bottom of things. This comes about really because there's a question of why is the universe friendly to life? It's been discovered that there are amazing coincidences without which life as we know it couldn't occur at all. I guess I'll be saying more about that in a moment, but I guess since it's out of order, Wheeler has a theory, for example, where, well, lots of people have theories, have suggested that in some way life acts back on the universe to make itself friendly to life. But anyway, next slide, I just have a few people who have been involved in this. There are actually musicians at each end and more scientific people in the middle. This is a songwriter that I happen to have found out about because my daughter, who's in a spare time, plays and sings with a band, covers some of the songs. So anyway, she made a very interesting statement about where music comes from, which started me thinking about critical points, as you will hear in a moment. Kaufman comes in because, well, let me see, what happened was I actually gave a talk in the TCM group a few weeks ago, based on just the idea that interesting things happened at critical points. But then I remembered, it's amazing all these coincidences, that Kaufman had an article in Nature which reminded me that he had a book called The Origins of Order, which has said very interesting things about how life arises, and I looked into this and found that this seems to be just the kind of picture you need to work out a proper theory of where mind is fundamental. In fact, yesterday I sent a draft paper to him, and he came back very encouragingly. He said, this looks nice, and the other nice thing is that he hadn't thought of doing this. It would have been a bit disappointing if he'd done it all. But anyway, Steve Rosen is a very interesting person. He has extremely strange ideas, and it's a challenge to understand what he's talking about. He likes paradox, and he is a follower of philosophers like Martin Heidegger, who are extremely incomprehensible, so he's very difficult to follow, but it's been a challenge. He also thinks that topological structures like Klein bottles are really how the universe works. Finally, Travis Carpenter is somebody who has had a music position at Trinity, and asked her what musicians thought about the meaning of music. So we collaborated, and there's a paper you can see my web pages on what can music tell us about minds, and our conclusion was that the usual view said nothing useful about aesthetics. And so there are some proposals we made which fit in nicely with this kind of thinking, so I'll be getting back to that in the end. But this is sort of a bit developed from the previous idea, so I'm just going to go rather quickly through a few slides here. As I said before, physics has presumed matter. That's how things are supposed to be. There's Newtonian mechanics, electromagnetic theory, and classical mechanics. Then quantum mechanics, well, you put in particles of matter like electrons, that presumes matter. Quantum field theory, again, you have fields which correspond to matter. String theory, well, they're still things. So you always presume matter or things at every stage in your theory. So the way our fundamental assumptions presume matter, and if life and mind are going to come in, they come in at a later stage in some kind of rare event occurs which just happens to allow life. So that's how it usually is. Now, as I said, this may be incomplete, and there are various problems. These are maybe a bit like the three clouds on the horizon, which I think people like St. Maxwell and so on thought physics was pretty well complete with classical mechanics, but there were little clouds which turned out to be very serious things. For example, the fact that the black body spectrum didn't come out right, and the question of why the electron didn't spiral into the nucleus, which one had thought it should, just radiate all its energy away. Well, here there's the observer problem in quantum mechanics. Well, I'm not going to say very much about that. Some of you will have heard about it. Observation is a little tricky, and you have to fudge to put it in the quantum measurements. Life, well, there's I have some slides about this later, but Niels Bohr suggested there was a problem applying quantum mechanics to life. Then there are things like higher cognitive abilities, like abstract mathematics. Now, Roger Penrose proposed that this means that there's something mysterious that we make contact with. Now, as happens, Penrose's arguments are faulty because he has an oversimplified view of how the brain works, that it's like a Turing machine. So that argument may not be right, but I think his result is nevertheless right. The point is that why do we have this ability to do the amazing abstract things, since it doesn't really help us survive, and it goes beyond ordinary reasoning. Similarly with music, that's part of the cognitive capacities. Music in some simple form might be serve a useful purpose, but why does the very subtle kind of music that's developed, why have we got that capacity, which is a sort of an unknown? Paranormal phenomena, well, it would appear that you can't explain things like telepathy, or sort of one picking up something at a distance, with the theories we have. There's a mysterious interaction at a distance, but it won't let you do that kind of thing. On the other hand, Bettini, Pellicari and I showed that you could use a variant of it which might allow for that, but that would be a different physics. So that's another problem. It's various phenomena which occur which don't can't readily be fitted into a standard theory, and all these things involve mind in some way. Well, I won't say any more about that. Bohr thought that quantum mechanics couldn't be applied properly to life, because it's really a question of how you can describe a living state. Technically, quantum mechanics doesn't tell you how to deal with unprepared systems. It's all about prepared systems where you can run through the postulates, and there's no clarity regarding quantum organization. So life is a bit mysterious. Now, Bohr, as it happens, was fiercely attacked by a physicist who said, "That's nonsense, Bohr." He said, "Perhaps you're right." So I wrote a paper, which is on my website, "Limits to the Universality of Quantum Mechanics," showing that Bohr was actually right, and there's a problem. In fact, it's become more of a problem with the way physics has developed because of the origin of the universe. But mathematical insight, musical appreciation, ESP, I've said about that. Gravity is a difficulty. People try, and it gets things didn't work out the way they hoped with the theory of everything. So there's a difficulty. Extra dimensions, and there's no observations which show that the guess as to how you can get around this is the right guess. So, well, in old times, epicycles worked, they gave the right numbers, but we know they're not the right theory. So the fact that quantum mechanics works so well doesn't actually prove anything. So, I was saying, we might it might be worth trying to get a different account of nature where life and mind are fundamental, but the problem is, how do you do this? Where would that description come from? I guess this should have come earlier, but I'm just going to backtrack a little now. There's a very nice book called The Goldilocks Enigma by Paul Davis. It's The Goldilocks Enigma, which is something to do with porridge being not too hot, not too cold, but just right. He describes all sorts of attempts to explain why the universe is nice for life when it would seem a priori much more likely it would be nasty for life. And Wheeler's proposal is that cosmos can give rise to life, and life has a mind, and then mind is supposed to act on cosmos, and so the cycle continues. Wheeler says this is in some way due to observation. Observers can actually influence things so they come out in a certain way. There may be some sense in this, but the difficulty is too vague. So we want a more advanced formulation of that idea. And the way we could do this, which I think is the way to go about it, is you start off with a fundamental theory of life, and you fit everything else into that theory. So, simple. That's a different starting point might give rise to different things. Just as a sort of preview of what that kind of approach might give, why it would be different from a usual approach, is there's a question of why is the universe the way it is? The answer would be that the minds would sort of organize the universe to be the way they like it, just as we would have a thermostat to make the temperature the way we like it. So that would be the criterion for determining what kind of universe we have, whereas the physicist's criterion is to say, symmetry groups are the answer, so let's find the right symmetry group. Okay, so that's rather different. So that would be one kind of way in which it would be different. But anyway, as I said a little while back, my starting point on this was the idea of a critical point, and this came to me. What actually happened was I had a visitor who was interested in consciousness, so we discussed consciousness and thought about various things. And I think it was because of that I looked back to this quotation I'd read on creativity. If you do a search on Parton and Trista, you'll get to this interview on the web. It's mainly about how they choose how a group, the Be Good Tanyas, how they decide what to do and so on. Usually they say we don't have a prescription, it just comes, we just do it, everything is spontaneous. Then the interviewer asked, said, a lot of your songs seem to be about death. Is there a reason for that? And she came back with the power, emotional power of death, and then said, when you stare into that space and that deepness, you get close to the place where things begin. And paraphrasing, that's a good place to be for making music. Well, this place where things begin suddenly made me think of critical points. A critical point is something where there's a gradual change from one regime to another. But as you approach the critical temperature, you get big fluctuations. So things are beginning at that place. So then I thought, well, is there anything interesting about that place which might be relevant to mind and life? And it did seem to be, which was in the talk I gave earlier. Just to express what I said a moment ago, on the left we have a situation above TC where nothing much is happening. We go towards the critical point and we get these fluctuations. So that was what looked promising. But then, as I said, this article in Nature reminded me I had this book, The Origins of Order, and he has some very neat concepts there. But the interesting thing is that it's not actually a mathematical theory. It talks, well, okay, it's not a theory where there are equations involving numbers, which physics is usually about. It's about abstract things like attractors, landscapes, hill climbing. That sort of things that actually biologists talk about. So it's as a well-defined theory, and he was able both to make models which exhibited these properties and to discuss their relationship with life. So there's a different kind of theory, so I've been looking into that, and that, as I said, that seems to be quite promising. Now, okay, a thing which he says is key is not quite a critical point, except it's more or less as I drew it, but the point is that it seems, as you can tell from models, that if you just take some system with things that interact, then if the interaction is low, you get nothing very much happening, or everything calm and orderly, and then things become more disorderly, and there's some point where there's chaos. In fact, an extremely simple equation will exhibit chaos. I think just one line, and you can plug it into the computer and see how that goes. I did play with this once, and nice solutions that go in a cycle suddenly become apparently random if anything's happened, and that's the simplest form of chaos, where regular behaviour turns into irregular behaviour. So he argued that this transition between regular behaviour and irregular behaviour, all of the same equations, just altering a parameter, would be key to life. Now, this is interesting because the people who've approached this from a more mystical direction have said something similar. Let me put both of these up. David Bohm talked about manifest and unmanifest order. He gave the example of an experiment that you could do, apparently. You put some sort of glycerine or something and put drops of ink in it, and you stir it around, and the drops all disappear, but then you stir the opposite direction, the drops come back again. So he's saying there's unmanifest order, there's the potential for order there, and you don't see it until it manifests itself. So Bohm was talking about, well, he said deeper and deeper meanings, and these deeper meanings are associated with an order which you can't readily see. Now Rosen, on the other hand, he has some weird books. He talks about apeiron, which is I think an idea of Anaximander, primal chaos from which order springs. There's an article in Wikipedia about that. So Rosen's idea is that things are really extremely irregular, but there are pockets of regularity, and then he says physics is the attempt to put order into this unordered quantity, this disordered region, and hence we get our theories, which are attempts to describe what order is there. And every now and then we managed to capture something which isn't in the theory and describe that, but things get into more and more of a mess, and he says it's because we're going about physics the wrong way, and we should instead use the method of phenomenology, which is topological. In this book, he claims to be able to derive all sorts of things, but it's so opaque that I've not managed to follow it in detail. But anyway, I think he's helped to inspire me there. But now let's look at the key concepts in Kaufmann's treatment. Well, he says life... his treatment is centred on ordinary life, nothing mystical about it. He's tried to apply this idea to social systems and economics, but he's just trying to describe ordinary life and explaining things like the origin of life and how life changes from one form to another. So the first idea is the edge of chaos, which I've talked about. Now, next thing, I'm slightly adapting his description. And abstracting out what I think is the most useful. The point is there are structures that form. But now there's what I call differential stability of the structure, because there are forces which tend to make structures, the ordering process, and the disordering process is tending to break them up. So if near the edge of chaos, you'd expect things to be very sensitive, and so there's great sensitivity in which structures can form. You can describe this stability in terms of the idea of an attractor, and thing here is a very famous example, the Lorentz attractor. This is an example of something which is given by a very simple equation. I think it's a differential equation. Lorentz, who invented it, was just playing around with equations to describe a web, and he found funny things. So here we have this amazingly complicated structure. It's an attractor because it stays within a certain region of space, and that's a characteristic of an attractor. It's a kind of stability. There's lots of things happening, but you don't get disintegration. Kaufmann talks about good attractors, which are more stable, and I invented the term smart system to describe that. A system is smart if it's... smartness simply means that it doesn't get disintegrate despite forces that might make it want to disintegrate. We think about these smart systems. First thing, as I've talked about, is that they are stable. That's the definition of smartness. But another thing is that they can cooperate to make smart complexes. And this is what we find in life. We find hierarchical structures building up. How does this happen? Well, one thing I think is that they get entangled. They constrain each other so that there isn't much. They can't move about too much, and so there's more chance that the whole system will be stable. Once you've got a knot, it's hard to break it up, sort of thing, is the intuition. So topology might be relevant there. Another thing he points out is important is that special kind of structures will be able to do things. Perform an interesting task rather than a random thing. Well, obviously that's at the core of biology. You have all sorts of structures which do things in the sense that as they run away, specific things happen. And this happens rather magically. It just happens that certain structures do things, do particular things, and biology makes use of those. And some way the doing things is related to life, because things have to be done to stop disintegration. So there's a nice little circle there. Now, doing things might involve doing specific computations, and this kind of system can compute because of its regular dynamics. So some systems, whatever computation has to be done, there might be some system that could do it. Well, then, the thing that these complexes might do is to communicate between each other, and by chance one system might in effect be able to ask another system to do something. That would involve, if a human being were doing it, you would design it so that it did this, but biology one just says that this happens by chance. By chance one gets some configuration which behaves in this sort of way. Now, as a point I should have mentioned here, normally this is supposed to depend on DNA, the information storage, but as long as you can get structures and they're somewhat stable and have some kind of topological properties, that structure can act as the information store. So you don't appear really to need chemistry. some kind of systems which have lots of structures might be able to do the same. It's just that life has become built upon a particular kind of structure provided by chemistry, but this sort of systems in general might be able to do it differently. Okay, well, also these systems might be able to anticipate what is happening, and by anticipating avoid awkward things happening, all sorts of things, mutual support. Also as the fact that individual systems may eventually die out, but a society can go on longer because individuals get replaced. Then there's a nice point he makes suggesting that the edge of chaos is important. You could describe these structures as some are rather frozen and some are more fluid. Frozen means that it'll retain its state. Fluid means that some changes may occur. So what you can do, and this is an idea by which a cybernetician called Ross Ashby thought up, it's a good strategy to have a system which changes when things aren't right and stops changing when things are right. So Kaufman's idea basically is that you can use the edge of chaos to cause things to change. So it'll be a good strategy if things go wrong to make things more chaotic and hope that things will eventually come right. So lots of nice ideas. Another thing that happens is that specialised systems develop in life, systems which do particular kinds of things. Well, then you can discuss how that would develop. Once a specialisation is useful, that usage of that particular kind of behaviour may tend to grow. So there are all these things you can say about smart systems. Now, is this just talk? Well, you can. Ideally, you could make models and theories, and Kaufman has done this kind of thing. So I believe it's general science, and genuine science. And, regular physics isn't in much better situation, actually. I talk to people, and they say, well, it's a great model. String theory does this, but we aren't quite sure how to do it. So it's, in a way, that's how science is. But this is certainly a potential research topic to see how one can develop this idea and apply it to actual situations. Well, so what are we getting at? The essential idea is that there's something which we can call mind, and which comes about in the sort of way I've been describing, but that's different from the universe, and mind makes universes. It's just one of the things it does as a domain where things happen, where there's space and time, which I'll talk about in a moment. And then this deeper level system may find it useful to have a surface level system to do things for it. So when one's developed this to a perfect theory, one will have a description of how actually universes benefit mind, but we don't know that yet. It's interesting how all this sounds a little theological, but of course that won't be talked about if I try getting it into nature. But it's one thing I wrote in a paper, an article in Physics Education entitled Science and Spirituality, the Next Grand Unification. And this is sort of drifting towards a unification of science and spirituality, because you have this sort of level behind what we can see. And it's all, in principle, a proper scientific theory, because we have the descriptions that go along with it. They just need working out in more detail. But anyway, if a model is mind giving rise to the universe, as this arrow shows, then your testing of it would involve a number of things. But main thing is, mind might influence the kind of universe we've got, and then we might, by looking at the universe, find out some things about mind. This is what people have already been doing with the anthropic principle, seeing what the way in which finding the universe is favourable to life in all sorts of ways. So one might understand that more. And also mind itself might be something that you can study better. What should I say? This description of mind may fit better with how minds actually behave. And I was suggesting that things like higher mathematics and music might be things which would have to be explained in terms of a deeper kind of mind which is not part of the material universe. Okay, well, now we get to various speculations. If you were to theorize about this, the idea is that deep life is using mind to build universes. And mind needs universes. Well, it's no good having a postulating universe which hasn't got a way of being built. This is a kind of consideration which isn't in the usual theory. You just say, well, the equation does it all. But now you need a process that builds universes, which would be sort of akin to the way life builds structures. For example, birds go in flocks just because there's a rule they obey which causes flocks, flocking behaviour. Termites build nests just by blindly following certain rules. So the real theory would talk about how a universe got built. And you might eventually write down equations for that. And if we find symmetries relevant to explaining the universe, then that might be a reflection of that being part of the how it's done. The mind might have representations which reflect symmetry as our visual system does. But it wouldn't be important. The elegance of the universe wouldn't be important. It's like if you're building a plane, the kind of wing you choose is the wing which has good flying qualities, and the aesthetic quality of the wing is secondary. You don't say, this wing looks nicer, so let's make our plane have this kind of wing. Whereas what scientists, physicists are doing at this point is sort of talking about universes that are nice, like supersymmetry, but that may not be how it goes at all. I was talking to someone at college, and he said, well, we might soon have an actual proof of supersymmetry in terms of what particle accelerators discover. And I said, well, perhaps it will end up disproving it and not fitting. Well, we will see anyway. Space and time. Well, this is a very tricky subject. Steve Rosen claims he knows about it. He talks about how dimensions are generated and so on. He has lots of strange ideas, but his point is that one shouldn't assume that space is the thing that we learn about from Euclid with like Cartesian geometry, say, just two coordinates and lengths and triangles and so on. Space is really a more complicated concept than that, and one ought to worry about how space is formed. In fact, lots of physicists are worrying about how space is formed as well, because one thing apparently which is awkward about superstrings is that they don't really explain space. Well, there's also time. Now, time is very confusing. I think Einstein just confused everybody by saying time is relative. And a way to get around this confusion is to say that the numbers that appear in physics are scientist time shown on a clock, and that's rather different from the time as we experience it, because we experience one time without any relativity, and it's just that clocks behave in a funny way, as Einstein found. But anyway, you could say, I can attempt to explain this point. The fact that we have space is because it has useful qualities, like things can be close together or separated, things can have a position, and there being space has all sorts of interesting implications. So it would be useful to have space and for not to be space, for things to be so muddled that space doesn't exist. again, it's useful to have time because we know we have a concept of being on time for something, which depends on being not time as we experience it, but having measures of time which we can work with. So what's really behind time might be the fact that there are various systems which have to be brought into synchrony, and when they're brought sufficiently into synchrony, these define physicists' time. Now, these are all rather tricky ideas, but there's some... the point is, anyway, space and time are non-trivial things. Space is connected with the act of becoming separate. Time is connected with cycles, which can be used to measure time. So, space and time represent some kind of organisation. Steve Rosen claims to understand all about this, so we hope he can do that bit of a theory. I thought I would illustrate this. I looked for things on the internet, and since I couldn't decide which of these pictures to use, I put in both. But my original scheme was you just have a tube called space, and then you want to the universe, you squeeze out space or space-time. On the other hand, this is a way you can make universes out of nothing. So, anyway, universes are created and organized somehow. Something like these cases I mentioned, like flocking of birds to night's nests. Right, what else might we get out of this? I said ESP does not seem to be explicable by ordinary physics because there's a theorem that says you cannot transmit a signal faster than light. But we might say, though, that space is just derivative, and outside space there are things happening. Space comes from something else, something deeper. When our minds tune into that deeper level, other things can happen. Well, I think it's a matter of experience that happens, and I think relationships are very funny things, but I don't quite know how to explain them. But it does, or to describe them, there seems to be an experience where people are connected more directly, which isn't like ordinary sensory connection. So you might therefore be able to explain ESP as saying that some system appeared at this level which ordinary physics doesn't know anything about, and being a single system which is connecting two people. I did actually write a paper on this sort of idea, a precursor of it, which the people who run the physics preprint archive didn't like. They first of all sent a message saying I wasn't allowed to post to the archive. I said, there seems to be a fault with your system. So they thought it would be bad publicity not letting me post to the archive. But they put it in the area called general physics, where there's a sort of dump. And since it did talk about things like the anthropic principle at this, and where mathematics might come from, I thought it should be of interest to people. But I filled in the form for cross-posting and got back messages like so-and-so, whatever number with, is, what's the word, is inappropriate for quantum theory. that's the unfortunate thing. And, they can just do what they like. They're dictators, and unless one had a way of stopping their funding, one can't stop them doing that kind of thing. They're law unto themselves. Now, let's move on to talk about creativity and higher minds. Well, this is comes out in an interesting connection with these ideas. The question which I've already introduced is whether all of creativity can be understood biologically. I mean, is there a biological reason for these things? Might it instead come from our deeper source? Could that explain anything? Well, perhaps. Let's go back now to Samantha Parton's comment about there being a place where things begin. I did the cognitive science part of collaboration, and Ms. Carpenter did the musical part, so I asked her what... I think my question was, is there anything one can say fairly rigorously about music? So she came up with the idea that there are themes which seem to have creative power and can be moved about from one piece of music to another. There's a quote from Schoenberg in the composer Schoenberg, not the low-temperature physicist Schoenberg, in our paper about, I don't have a quote here, but it's something about composers being able to appreciate the germs which are, and appreciate their creative potential and use that knowledge to make the music. So we have putting these two things, both suggesting that there is something rather mysterious, something with creative potential there, which is used. And the idea I had is that it's like a gene. There are many papers show parallels between genes and these musical themes. And what is it about a gene? Well, a gene is something that performs a specific task. It's quite a complicated thing, but it's one of these things that performs a specific task. Again, functions in computer programs are like that. So there's a logic that fits very well with what I was saying before, in that systems that can perform tasks are an important part of the whole mechanism of life. So what this suggests is that there's some kind of atoms of mind which are, well, very much like genes or functions which it's which computer scientists find it, or computer programmers find it convenient to define. And because they're so useful, they are found. And these come about out of all these self-organization processes. And also, so ideas would be that kind of thing as well. And then the nice thing is, these systems have a very complicated inner dynamics, and that inner dynamics can be a thing that does things. It's like a bit of computer code having its inner structure which causes it to do things. So that all fits. So in other words, there might be some kind of music going on at the deepest level of nature. So well, it all fits together. Sometime we may have a proper mathematical treatment of it all, but this is early days, so about the days of Dalton's chemistry. Yeah. So, well, you could say what I've been proposing is an extension of science, because mind's been added, a whole new thing is added into the picture, and we have some ideas as to how to handle it, but not the usual equations. They're the rather complicated ideas like attractors and information processors. Of course, quantum theory regards information as fundamental as well, so there may be lots of links with conventional science. Well, that would lead, I think, to taboo ideas becoming a part of science. I don't mean a respectable part, a reluctantly accepted part of science, one should perhaps say, because they will come nicely out of this picture. So I just have a kind of listing here. And, well, telepathy, obviously one. Memory of water, well, that's funny thing, that does seem to exist. And people who say, no molecules, no effects, simply don't understand liquids. And people who understand liquids know that quite funny things happen in water, so it's not at all impossible. Cold fusion, well, that's been demonstrated abundantly, but it's had a bad press, so people assume it doesn't exist. Hopefully they will change and become a source of power. So I said at some point this theory looks a bit like theology, and I can imagine that intelligent design is real. Intelligent design is rejected just because it's part of the scientific culture, that it cannot be true, you must not talk about it. But it's not actually disproved, and I think it will turn out that there is design and the usual theories are wrong there as well. And now something, well, the last thing is actually just a joke, but it's a joke I thought of a long time ago, but in the year I make things get smaller and smaller, they become more doubtful. In the year 2025, I thought maybe there'll be an occult science tripos and an institute of astrology in the university. So that's things may be interesting if this all works out. So, thank you very much. Thank you.